Hi, my name is Salema Mabena Masakela. I'll say it for you one more time. Salema Mabena Masakela. And you are listening to the What Shapes Us podcast. Hi, friends. Yes, we're back. You are listening to the What Shapes Us podcast. My name is Salema Mabena Masakela. Back by popular demand. Well, not really, but actually, you know what? Y'all have been knocking at the door in the DMs, etc., being like, bring it back, buddy. If you're new here, welcome. If you're a patron that has been walking by this establishment on a regular basis and saying to yourself, I wonder if they're ever going to reopen. Are they going to serve us the conversations again? I was enjoying them. Welcome back. We're here. This is the grand reopening. Well, we'll call it a soft reopening. We're serving up some meals from the old menu. I'll explain. I'm talking in circles. I'm talking in circles because this is like a car that you've driven before, but it's been sitting in the garage for a very long time, and you know you're just trying to see if you still know how to drive. I'm trying to see if I still know how to drive the What Shapes Us podcast. I haven't done an episode in almost a year during the lockdown of the lockdown of COVID before the world was even remotely open. It was really easy to focus. And then life started trickling back into almost being normal, but also not normal at all. And you're just kind of trying to keep balls in the air. And turns out I only have two hands. And I was working with hands, feet. I was juggling some on my head, all as we all have been in sort of this COVIDicus dance. And anyway, long story short, we're back. And before we get into like new episodes, I've had some content. No one says that, Salema. I've had some episodes stored up, some conversations stored up that just never made it to see the light of day. And so they're going to see the light of day right now. And I'm excited to be back. I'm basically very excited to be back on the What Shapes Us podcast. And I hope that y'all will stick around. What have I been up to? I've been working out a lot because I turned 50, and the 2 weeks before my 50th birthday, I got a AARP card in the mail. They're so, which I thought was very offensive. It was like, okay, look, yes, I know that I'm entering into a new group, but do y'all have to send me an ID card before they sent me an AARP card with my name on it to be like, you can't hide from us. You're old now. And seeing the AARP card made me double down on the fitness. So if you follow me on Instagram, you see me posting workouts. I'm basically, it's less vanity and more sort of a call out to all those who may be in or around my demographic. Like either you keep moving or you're just going to live in your memories. You're just going to be playing the greatest hits in your mind. And guess what? I'm not ready to do that. I'm not ready to play the greatest hits in my mind. I feel like I got some hits left with this bag of bones and skin and limited muscle in decline. So I've been in the backyard doing my fitness, trying to inspire people to move. I've been traveling a little bit where I can. Some snowboarding has been nice. Went to Senegal, did some surfing. I'll talk about that, I'm sure, in future episodes. Lots has been going on. Put out a book called Afro Surf with my clothing company, Mami Wata, which is a fantastic surf lifestyle brand that I brought over from South Africa and is now launched in the U.S. You can check it out at MamiWataSurf.com. Taking the surf lifestyle genre, which, you know, traditionally you see through a very blonde hair, blue-eyed lens of Southern California and or Australia, and said, yeah, let's see what this looks like with a decidedly African bend. And it's been going pretty cool. People are discovering that there is an African storm taking place, a explosion of Afro surf culture, thus the book Afro Surf, available at all bookstores. Or if you want to help Jeff Bezos get the space, again, you can buy it on Amazon. It's doing really well. New York Times called Afro Surf its favorite holiday coffee table book. Yeah, I didn't even know that was a category, but got a note from the PR team that said, hey, look at y'all, number one in the coffee table holiday gift guide. I said, you know what, we'll take it. It's 320 pages of surfing, but entirely through the lens of the largest continent on Earth that most people are not familiar with, Africa. 54 countries of joy. Not a country, a continent. 54 countries. And I'm excited about this book because, well, it's a Trojan horse of sorts, you know? Most people, when they think about Africa, they think about Africa from the perspective of, you know, I'd really like to go on a safari and see the animals. Or maybe climb Kilimanjaro. Or you know what? It'd be really nice to go and, you know, help dig some wells for those people over there because they need so much help. Meanwhile, Africa's like, you know, we're the illest place on Earth and we're influencing global culture all day long. Music, art, food, design, history. You can't pick up your cell phone without holding Africa in your hand, basically. And so this book, it takes you on a journey through what modern Africa is today through this very unlikely lens of surfing. So check it out, Afro Surf, the book. Very excited. This conversation today is with an incredible woman by the name of Rada Blank, a.k.a. Rodimus Prime, rapper, writer, director, actor, one of the most honest people that I've ever met in my life. In other words, like, Rada Blank is just incapable of pulling a punch when it comes to speaking her truth. And as a Black woman aiming to make it as a writer in Hollywood, ain't easy. It's not the perspective that I would say people are knocking down the door to get on films and in television. But nonetheless, Rada has persevered in theater, persevered writing for television and other films, and then finally got this incredible opportunity with her own project that she wrote, directed, and starred in called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Essentially based on her life, about her character's struggle as a Black woman from Harlem trying to get the white world to see that her stories matter, that her voice matters in the dance. It's a very, very incredible movie. Had a chance to watch what it was doing at Sundance in 2020, right before we went into lockdown. Won the Vanguard Award at Sundance and then got picked up by Netflix. And then it was just off to the races. I met Rada in 2015 through my sister and a former guest on this podcast, Joy Bryant, who was like, I met this dope woman named Rada, and I just think y'all would get along. You should have coffee. And Rada and I had coffee, And as you'll hear in our conversation, we hit it off so well. It was right around the time that Donald Trump had announced that he was running for president. And we both had the same, we both were struck by it by the same, in the same way, where it was like, ah, this is funny and not funny at the same time. This represents some things in our society. And so we made this short called Sam Bo that ended up on Funny or Die. We wrote it together, and Radha directed it and directed me, directed yours truly, playing this character, Sam Bo, who was essentially Donald Trump's secret black speechwriter. Yes, imagine that. And who knew? Who knew it would end up being so prophetic? But anyway, I'm really glad that I got to have Radha on the podcast. I'm so sorry, Radha, that it took so long for this thing to come to life. But I feel like a conversation like this is timeless because she is truly a timeless human being and someone who's going to be making plenty more noise. We need voices like a Radha Blank in art and in the culture, Radha Blank for the culture. Enjoy this conversation on the What Shapes Us podcast with my friend, Radha Blank. I like your backdrop. There's a thing on Twitter called Room Raider. And
okay,
I follow them because sometimes you need more than just like macabre news all day, like because the world is shit. And they rate people's, they screen grab and rate people's backdrops from like Zoom interviews and such, and they point out like plant ratio, art, wall texture, and it's just a simple like 9 out of 10 with like a brief synopsis. It brings me joy. If you were on Room Raider right now, I think you'd do very well.
Oh, I'm gonna have to check that out. That sounds like my kind of thing.
I brought it up, knowing your digital.
How are you?
Your digital tone. I'm well. I'm well. You know. I mean, it's been it's been a year, and every time I feel like it's like they kicked everybody out the club and we can get to cleaning up, it's like, oh, there's still some assholes that was hiding in the
stragglers
that are hiding in the bathroom or hiding under tables, and they're still here with all of the bullshit.
Yep.
That's I woke up today feeling like I was going to be optimistic, and I hadn't seen any of the Dante Smith shit that's taking place in Minnesota. And it just really, really took me out. I had to go for a walk today, Radha. I got hit with like weird panic overwhelm that was very reminiscent to what it felt like last summer. And I just got to go outside and breathe.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like just the cycle, you know, it's unrelenting. And just when it looks like something's going to let up.
Yeah. It's like, oh, we might have collectively learned some shit to move forward. And everyone's like, no.
No.
We can't do that.
There's way too much deep embedded sickness in this country. Mm. You know, like, it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
A long while. I mean,
I resolved to be like, oh, this might not be on us. Like, younglings, we'll be here in support.
Yeah.
It's really sad way to think. I started watching The Brutes.
What is it? Extinguish?
Extinguish All the Brutes.
Yeah. I'm not ready.
I should not have. But then after one, I got, I was like, okay, I'm in. And I did two, mm-hmm. I did two of them. And then I won't be able to watch anymore for like another couple of weeks. It's just so yeah. thorough. And it's like, I'm also was like, what do you expect? It's Raoul Peck. Like, do you think he was going to be Raoul Peck light? No. But it's so like brilliant the way it layers the documentary end of it. But then like there's all this scripted stuff and he really like fucks with time. And the music is also like aggressively fuck you, like really light pop music mm. over like the most fucked up shit and necessary. Mm. But also to go from that into Dante Smith this morning. And then there was like some mass shooting at a school in Tennessee. I was like, I need to go outside.
Yeah.
How are you doing? Where are you?
I'm in Baltimore. I split time between here and New York. And it's rainy right now. But yeah, I'm kind of in the same place. I, like a lot of people, I've been very numb. You know, because I think if we weren't having the fucktard, you know, that is coronavirus, if we weren't in that space, then we'd be together. And for someone like me, that's like an important part of my, I don't know, catharsis. Mm. You know, it's how I, you know, replenish my energy, whatever is with other people. And, you know, that's not happening for me and a lot of people. And so you just, there's just this kind of numb, like a drunk, like a, I guess like a sound of a drum, like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? So it's like, and then spending a whole year kind of in a virtual box, you know, this is not me complaining. This is me just
it's
observing
accurate.
And expressing the reality. It's like, I didn't, for a person who, you know, wants to open a restaurant called No New Friends. I'm really finding myself needing people right now, you know, in a way that I, one, didn't anticipate, and just, I completely underestimated like my need to be around people. And I'm not just talking about my typical friends. I mean, just like, you know, engaging folks around something that you've offered, you know, it's all happening in a virtual box. And I found myself on Twitter, which I don't need to be on there really, because I be getting into fights and shit with people over dumb shit. Dumb shit, you know?
It's really funny when you're in the shit and you realize, like, oh, I shouldn't be here. But then there's also part of you like, well, we're here, so let's go.
We're here. You done said some dumb shit and tagged me in it. So, come on. Like, you know, like, again, I think if I was out in the world, you know, like, when I think about, like, say you're at a Q&A or something, and somebody gets out of the audience and they say some zesty shit, like, sometimes you don't even have to say anything. You can just let someone else in the audience be like, excuse me now, you know, but there's no, I don't get to hear the sighs or the, you know, because there's something about going to a Q&A for a film screening in New York. Like, it's just one of my favorite things when that person, you know, the person hosting says, okay, we only have 10 minutes. Please limit your question, you know, and then the person gets up. And it's not even a question. They just like, you know, I appreciate the film and everything. I just don't know why you had the dog come in there and talking for 10 minutes. I mean, it's a dog. You know, I miss that shit.
Right.
You know, in the Twitterverse, it doesn't feel like the typical character fare. It just feels like people trying to tear your shit apart. And There's a visual artist, Amy Sherald. I hope she doesn't mind me sharing the story about how, like, you know, she did the Michelle Obama portrait. And she said that for the most part, people were like loving on her and just appreciative of the work. But out of like the 90,000 comments, there was that one person. And that for some reason, those are the things you tend to look at when, like, you know, the most of the responses are positive. You can't help but focus on that person who says something that, like, kind of cuts deep or whatever. So
why do you think that is? Because I'm the same way. And for the most part, most of the people who fuck with, you know, what I do on social media are really warm, and even sometimes people will give criticism or point of view that's constructive, or like put me onto something that I missed, and I'm like, oh, thank you. But then, you know, there's that person who like just has been studying you and crafting, like, ah, here is how I can get this person's whole
in the undergird, right? Like a shiv in that prison fight. They're like,
right between the ribs.
Yeah, I'm going to go right up under the kidney. I'm going to puncture the kidney with this one. You know what I think? I think, you know, first of all, like we're in a space where we are taking something from inside and sharing it with a greater audience. Mm. And it requires a certain level of vulnerability. You are exposing yourself, your ideas, how your mind works, your personality. And I think it's just a defense, you know, reflex. It's like, this thing I've put out is someone's trying to puncture.
Right.
And, you know, like, some of my friends are like, what are you doing? Why are you wasting your time? Why are you giving, you know, why are you even making that person relevant with their 10 followers or whatever? I just think it's a defense, you know, yeah. Like you maybe in the back of your mind have kind of been preparing for this in some way. It's like, you just know how things work in this world now, you know, like, I mean, we have terms like cancel culture and haters, and, you know, there's just a tendency when you put something out that somebody's going to scrutinize it. And, you know, you have that, the thing I keep hearing my friends say is like, you know, everything is not for everybody and everybody's not going to love the things that you do, no matter what your intention is. So I feel like it's just an immediate defense, you know, and maybe you're just testing yourself to see, like, can I handle this kind of exchange? But me, I think it's like, two things. I'm from New York.
Right.
I definitely didn't have enough fights as a kid. You know what I'm saying? Like, I could have scrapped more. And so a part of me is like,
it's regret.
You know, at one point somebody got on Twitter, right? And I don't actually, it's not that I want to fight. I'm just a smart ass. So this one girl was like, okay, when we going to admit that we don't really like, we ain't fucking with the 40-year-old version. So I just said something. I said three words. I was like, go off, sis. Go off. Come on. You know, like, thing is they're not expecting you to respond. But if you want to use my name in some shit.
Right.
And then sometimes you're going to tag me in some shit. You know, I'm from New York. I'm going to say, I might say something.
Right. Oh, you thought that
might say a little something.
Yeah. You thought that what I was doing on screen and then that story and who that character was and all that wasn't actually of me. Oh, okay. Allow me to actually show you what I couldn't put in the film.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, Brownsville, Harlem, all of that shit is still with me. And right. Now I'm in Baltimore. So, like, sometimes I just want to say, Molly, what's good? You know what I mean? Like,
what's really?
But I gotta be, you know, you gotta be careful because there are people who, you know, they have a beehive mentality and they love your shit. And so they're like, if you say something in the comment, like go off or thanks. Sometimes I just do thanks. Yo, those people will come in like piranha. You know what I mean? So, and I'm not into that bullying shit. Right. I don't condone that. So I do sometimes just have to be quiet, and it's hard because
right.
that's not my personality.
So you're saying you got a hive. There's a prime hive.
I wouldn't call it a hive. Maybe it's like a gathering, a smattering of fans who like in all the in the awards campaign, you know, that trail, which I am very grateful to that it's finally over. We could talk about that.
You just got you just got a DGA nom though, didn't you?
I did. I did not win. It went to Darius Martyr.
Okay.
For The Sound of Metal, which, come on, you're going to lose to somebody. You know what I mean? Like
That's a lose win.
I still can't believe that's his first film. But in the whole process of campaigning, you know, there are people who like, I know one thing. If Rada Blank's Poverty Porn don't get nominated, yeah, and if she don't get nominated for first, I mean, like, people are, like, very passionate about the things that they love. You know, so I've seen some of that stuff, and then I turn the other way. Like, I run out of that room or that post because people go in. Mm. And I appreciate it because, I mean, it's a version of love. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there are more people who have that stance than those that are trying to
right
be like, ah, you failed. You tried and you failed. Yeah, whatever. It's black and white, but it ain't no classic. And I'll just be like, anyway,
one thing about the detractors is they're usually so basic that I actually feel for them. Like, oh, you put that out into the ether and really thought that you did something. Like, ah, okay,
right.
I'm just gonna let you be. Or as Amanda Seale says, be blocked and be blessed, which I have been doing a lot more lately. Just like, instead of fucking with you, I'm just gonna vamoosh you. And
yeah,
that feels that so much too. Better.
At the end of the day, there's nothing more powerful than that. But I think I blame COVID. I blame everything on I'm usually always blaming everything on white supremacy. as to why I'm not in like relationships with five great guys. I always blame white supremacy, but now I'm blaming COVID. I was like, yeah, you know, if we didn't have a pandemic, I would be out in these streets with people partying, having a good time. And instead I find myself on Twitter and I'm going to end that eventually. I'm going to be the bigger person. But sometimes it's just so tempting. You know what I mean?
There is a light catharsis sometimes into, you know, bumping someone in the street and being like, you got a problem?
You know, somebody steps on your new Jordans.
Mm.
Sometimes you just want to stare them down like, word. Word. And then keep it moving. Which is why that Nicki Minaj VMAs moment where she's like, Miley, what's good? Like, that just... I think I'm going to get that tattooed on my back. Miley was good because it just gives me so much. You know what I mean?
Maybe straight across the top.
Yeah.
Like just below your neck. Like Miley was good.
Right. And then like sometimes it'll just say good, mm-hmm. you know, depending on what I'm wearing or what's good.
Sometimes
and then
just Miley say Miley. Good. I'll pay for it. You find the artist and
So listen. We got you on record saying that.
Send me that Cash App. I got you. There was something that I love that you did this year. I mean, listen, it's been really, really a blast for me, especially to watch the last year plus for you. Because I am more than just a fan in that you and I got to know each other in 2015 via mm-hmm. our mutual homegirl and a What Shapes Us podcast alum, Miss Joy Bryant. And
the one and only.
The one and only, Joy Beezy. Your mother. That's her voice.
Love her to 10 million people.
She's the best. She's the best. We're conspiring on something right now as we speak, that I'll talk to you about later that I think you'll be psyched on. But, you know, Joy has always, what I love about my friendship with Joy is she's that person who pushes you and doesn't let you hide from your gifts. And so with me, it's always been like, yeah, Negro, we know that you're a great, you know, commentator, but like your creativity and what I think you have to give, as an actor, etc. Like, I'm never going to let you sleep on that, which is very humbling from, you know, that type of friend where it's like, thanks, but I'm good. I'm doing my thing. She's like, I know you're doing your thing, but like, you have more to give. So always pushing you, you know, to write, to like, to create and build. So when she introduced me to you, it was in that. It was like, I remember she just called me up one day. She's like, there's someone that you have to meet that I just met who's the most dynamic, incredible, badass writer, director. And she's of us. Y'all just have to meet. Mm. And when we sat and met, first of all, I think we sat for like 4 hours for coffee that first time we met.
It was on Wilshire.
Yes.
Right?
Across the street from the old E building.
I think so.
Yeah. It was in the Starbucks on Wilshire across from the old E building I used to work at, 5750.
Yep.
And I remember like within 10 minutes being like, A, I think I've known this woman for my whole life. And B, like, we just went on a ride. You know, we went on a ride. And it was an interesting time because it was literally maybe 3 or 4 weeks in the wake of Donald Trump making his announcement that he was going to be president, like coming down the escalator in what at the time, for the first minute, felt like an SNL skit. But then to see the way a huge sector of white America was reacting on some like, yes, finally, there was that little feeling that it was like everyone on like the aggressive liberals being like, ha, 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 never. Even the Republicans, like the real like the card carrying Republicans were like, this is a nuisance, but we'll get past it. And then you and I had that conversation where we were like, yo, this shit, it feels like it's actually going to happen.
Well, I remember us also saying, like, damn, what did we do?
Right, we got to do something.
Like, did we somehow trip something off in the universe in having this conversation? You remember when we were like, I think it was done. I think the piece was done. I don't know. I feel like at one point we were like, did we just do some juju or something? And because, you know, we created something that I'm still very proud of, that Sambo.
Likewise. Skit. And for context to the audience, from this conversation, you're right. In the midst of the conversation, we were like, I think we just created something. And then you were like, and we need to actually make this thing.
Right.
I was like, word?
Because didn't it start off as like you saying, okay, I need to be on tape for something. And then within an hour, it was like, nah, let's create. Yeah, okay, that's good. That's important. That's necessary. And that's a priority. But what if like we create something around this, you know, need to be on tape. And we created the sample.
We created a
Sambo speechwriter for Trump skit.
Yeah, Sambo, Donald Trump's black speechwriter.
Right. And it was on Funny or Die.
Yeah.
And it did so well on there. And we all had a good laugh because we were like, yeah, because it's never going to happen.
Right. And then, a year later, he was president. And it was like, there literally were like a bunch of Sambo characters in the that showed up. I played Sam Bo, Samuel R. Bo, Sam Bo.
Right. Distinction, exactly. Sam Bo,
the
sure.
Speechwriter for Donald Trump, explaining, justifying how he wasn't really a racist, but he was a racist. And you just, you were, the way you directed me in that, I remember even the way you challenged me to be like, all right, cool. That was cool. But like, now let's get into it. And I was like, oh. And but your bedside manner as a director, that's when I was like, oh, wow, this woman is a super force. And you brought out something in me that I did not even know I had access to. And I from that piece.
Oh, wow.
No, and I've never gotten to give you your proper flowers because the world moves so crazy. But yeah, you brought out something in me that I never even knew that I had access to. And it was such a thrill.
Well, the timing of us doing that, I'm thanking you because the timing of that was like, I didn't know I needed to do that. And, I realized like, you know, like I said, this last year, I've just been talking, kind of selling the film, but there's nothing like being on set and there's nothing like working with an actor who enlivens. You know, you share something with them and then they take it to the next level. Like we were done. It was so quick. And I was just like, man, that was fun. That was exciting. It was fun. You know, and I felt like I didn't feel like what we were doing was dangerous, but I definitely felt like, oh, like what are people going to say when this comes out? And you were amazing. You really were. And I know this was you being on tape for something else, you know, but there's no question in my mind that you need to do more of that version of storytelling, you know, where you're kind of embodying a character because we kind of had a script, but then you just like, you started going off on some improv shit. And I was just like, yeah, like that's, it was a good time. It was a good time. And you definitely shined in that moment.
Well, I appreciate
it. You gotta do more. You have to do more.
Yeah. I've gotten to do some more and there's more to come. Building some things, but you know, I remember where you were at, you know, you at the time you had a palpable frustration with the, how do I say the fuckery of the business
of the biz
of the Hollywood business. And you were on your grind, you know, you had just come out to LA and you were kind of sniffing it out to see like, okay, what's really popping out here. And I, as I started to see your name popping up in things, like I remember when I saw it in credits, like she's got to have it. I was like, oh, okay. Okay. You know, and then it was this and it was that. I always just had this huge wealth of pride to be like, I know what this woman has to give. And when it happens, the world is going to know. And you know, when I heard about the 40-year-old version, when Joy called me and I was going out to Sundance. I didn't even know you had a film there. And Joy was like, oh, Radha's got like the hottest film on the block at Sundance. I was like, you need to stop. She's like, yeah. She told me the whole backstory, et cetera. She's like,
she's such a gem.
She's like, Radha has the hottest shit on the block. Like that's, you know, she's like, you know that film when you're at Sundance and people are like, Have you seen? Oh yeah, I heard it's amazing. I'm trying to get in. She's like literally how she said it. She's like, that's the film that Radha has at Sundance, the 40-year-old version. I was like, no way. And when I went, so I started doing my like, you know, how do I get a ticket type thing. I wasn't gonna call you because that would be just horrible. Like, hey, remember me from 5 years ago? I'm at Sundance for your premiere. She's like, Negro, oh, what?
Stop. Not even please.
And nah, I had finally got my hands on a ticket. And I think I texted you to be like, hey, I'm here. I'm so excited. I'm getting in.
I know. That was so sweet.
And then it was literally the hottest ticket. Like the what was going on and the posturing and the stories that people were telling to try to get in, because I guess the fire marshal had cut off people getting into the building, was real. And that woman had just come, she had taken like a little group of us and said, okay, you guys are getting in. Like, be cool. And I was like, yes, universe. And then I got to the front.
God bless that woman.
I got to the front and the lady was like, yeah, I'm so sorry, but yeah, we're just full. The fire marshal's inside and you can't. I mean, there are people who are associated with the film who can't get in. So we're so sorry. And I was like, no, but you understand, like, that's my, you know, you want to like give them the, we made a short film together 5 years ago on Funny or Die.
Right. Oh my God.
But you know what? I was just, it was enough for me to stand outside the film and see these agents and actors and all these people clamoring to get in for your shit. And I walked away just proud and full of joy. And I was like, I'm going to see it when it's time for me to see it. But I was just so immensely thrilled.
I wish you would have told me. I had no idea you didn't get in.
No, it's okay. I mean, you were doing your thing. You got to let your people be. We've all been there. So yeah. And then to see the ride that you've been on the last year with it has been, first of all, I mean, the film is just amazing. I sat home and watched it when I finally got a screener, and I was just in awe of you. Like these days.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, these days, the bravery to continue to back yourself, like to have the belief that what it is that you have to give, no one else has to give. And in this business, what traditionally happens is people take a look at your talent and then they tell you all the ways to take that talent and make it a little bit like this person and a little bit like that person and that, yeah, so that you can work
palatable
and make it digestible, yeah, and we can make money, and you find yourself at that crossroads like, oh, well, maybe this is what I do. I do everybody else's shit so that I can do my shit. And you did the complete opposite. And in a way that, like, there's just not many stories like it to me, especially when it comes to, like, belief in reinvention, knowing that you have access to a few different versions of yourself, and in a culture, in a business that, like, there's ageism in the world in general, but then, like, ageism in this business is just like some complete other shit. And you made a film that said,
"Oh, forget it."
You made a film that said, "Fuck you" to all of that, and I think is a gift to people when it comes to, like, acceptance. Like, true acceptance of self and who you are. And that yes, there might be 8 billion of us on the planet, but literally no one has your shit.
Yeah, and I feel like it is, I always say making the film is probably the biggest, boldest act of self-love I could have done, because, you know, the film becomes an extension of you. I mean, it is based on my life. And so it's not like this is a separate narrative. I mean, we shot in my apartment. The guy playing my brother is my brother. That's my mom's artwork, my dad's jazz music. And yeah, I mean, that's another conversation for us to have. I mean, hopefully we can talk on, you know, about coming in the shadow of the legacy of an artist, you know, maybe just the pressures that come with that. But, you know, this was an extension of my personal life story. And I'm having to pitch in different circles around financing and space and time and resources to convince people that it's worth their time and resources, you know. And it's like you're pitching for yourself and you're saying, I am valid. My story is valid. It's worth your time. And I think where it becomes challenging is, like, it's not a story that is familiar to most of the people who have the power to greenlight something like this. So, you know, I'd met numerous potential financiers and potential producers over the years who, you know, they were like, okay, you know, I like the script, it's very funny, but maybe we should put this person in it instead of you. And maybe we should, you know, shoot it for half of what you're asking. And maybe we should, you know, all these little things that, you know, yes, they are compromising. They are little compromises of the vision, but really they start to feel like they're personal compromises because of how connected, personally connected I am to the film. But I compare finding the right producer like finding a life partner, like that person who is going to take you as you are. And that's what I found in Lena. It's like, I'm sure it had everything to do with the fact that she is also a Black woman. So it's a no-brainer for her. Whereas other people are just like, I don't know about the relevance of the story. You know, it was not a huge risk for her. And I feel like it's the same thing in partnership. Like you see somebody for who they are, you go, I'm not only fine with this, I love this person, you know, and their flaws. And, you know, I mean, people have, like I said, I've had my detractors. What's up, Miley? Miley was good. not the actual Miley Cyrus for those who didn't get that part of it. Anyway, but at the end of the day, I wasn't trying to make a perfect film. You know, I was just trying to make a film that was perfectly me. And it kind of reinvigorated my level of confidence about my standing in, I wouldn't say Hollywood. I know that the film is maybe considered mainstream. It's on a, you know, mainstream platform like Netflix. But just in terms of storytelling, like the landscape of storytelling, that I deserve to be there just like anybody else that's there right now. You know, it's not to say that I'm not in an interesting or odd dance with the industry now, because I thought that, you know, some people make a first film to break into the business. I made a film to break away from it. You know, like I was a writer for hire for many years, a hired gun. And so I thought, oh, this voice, this film, the voice is so specific and so clearly like singular that moving forward, the expectation is that I would build on that. Not necessarily, according to you know, the industry. You know, some of the asks or requests, they tickle me. They tickle me a little bit. I remember at the beginning of 2020, before that thing called Corona came into our lives, I was fortunate enough to receive the Variety magazine's 10 Directors to Watch Award. And I had just gotten off the stage. You know, I had my award at my bosom, where I like to hold things that are sacred to me, right there at the bosom. And this older white man producer comes up to me and he was like, congratulations, I can't wait to see your film. It hadn't come out at that point. It was just buzzy.
Right.
And he said, it's so great. You're on a 10 Directors to Watch list. That's amazing. I'm a producer and I would love to talk to you about this story about a Black woman runaway slave. I was in an episode of Charlie Brown. It was like, wah, 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 slave, wah, 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 run to freedom, wah, 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 learns to read, wah, 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 wah. And I was just sitting there and I had the award, like I said, right at my bosom. And here he is. I looked around for the cameras. I said, damn, this movie, I thought I edited this shit. Are we still on set? Like, no, this is really happening. So
it's literally a scene from your actual movie.
Son. Like, you know, like some people catch the fact that every time we talk about this historical Black drama, the name change, you know, it's like insert historical Black figure here, you know, like Shirley Chisholm, Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells. And I can talk about why I did that, but this was a movie, and here I am. I done finished editing the movie, and it has come to life. It has come to truth, you know. And let me just say why part of like you know, I guess I'm one of those people who I'm not an activist, but I was a stand-up comic for 6 years, you know, fumbling in those years in around New York. And I do think that, you know, if you can use humor to, you know, shine a light on some unfunny things, then let's do it. And I think where that whole historical Black drama thing came in was the fact that, like, for some reason, like, when we're telling contemporary stories with Black people in them, they're just not as relevant. And I realized that for a lot of Hollywood, especially those who are performing their anti-racism, like, you can't argue with Black history. This Black person lived and died. And they did something important. So that means they're subject for a movie. And my thing is just like, you know, where's the story about the Black surfer? Where's the story about, you know, the person who has an identity as a host and then decides to do some acting, you know, and the industry is like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, we're so varied in our experiences. It just seems like there's a limitation around what experiences of ours are valid and worthy and sacred, you know, that it has to be attached to some looming legacy in the country of Americas. It can't just be about some woman who's like, my mom died. Yeah, I'm about to be 40. Am I relevant? Am I speaking my truth? You know what I'm saying? Right. I just feel like, and this was like to the people who were like, oh, you gonna win an Oscar. Child, I can't compete with Black history. I cannot contemporary Black driven comedy.
Right.
Against Black figures.
Right.
I ain't betting on that horse personally. I'm kind of rambling now, but yeah.
You're like, not I rambling. Just you're speaking an abundance of truth. And it's something that I find myself, not just myself, we're having these conversations as Black people all the time. Like, hey, listen, when do we get to just be? Like, when do we make things about us just being and like going through certain periods of life and being multidimensional? And guess what? At the end, everyone's laughing because that's also Black life. And it seems like there has been this like very genius model that white people have had in Hollywood to say, like, we can condition the audience to only believe in Black struggle. And the idea of like, wow. Like it, without Black struggle, what are Black people?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. It's like, right. Like when it comes to Black storytelling, trauma is the conflict. Conflict shows up as trauma. You know, it can't be one of my favorite films, Losing Ground by Kathleen Collins. It can't be about a Black woman philosophy professor who feels like she's not exciting enough. That if she isn't, you know, she can't keep her husband turned on, you know, like that, you know, even though there's conflict there and there is an emotional pain or challenge for the character, in terms of those mainstream audiences or the Hollywood audiences or the gatekeepers, it doesn't feel relevant enough. It's, you know what I mean? Like, it has to be something like if this professor got up one day and on her way to college, she got shot in the neck and now she's paralyzed from the neck down and she got a teach up the side of her mouth. You know, there was, from the people who brought you my left foot, it's my side mouth talk. You know, like, I don't know. Like, we, like, us just going through the motions of a regular existence, which has its peppered with its own version of pain and, you know, and sadness or what have you, challenges and triumphs. Like, it just, like I said, it can't compete. It either has to be pain porn. Right, you know, right. Where we are being traumatized in every single scene, or it has to be rooted in something that happened in the past, you know, and
not just like basic struggle. Can we just have basic
struggle? Basic I struggle overcome. So like I said, where's the story about the guy who's trying to, you know, be a surfer? You know, he's divorced and doesn't have much left, and he decides to return to surfing. Oh yeah, and the guy's black, you know, and so that's going to be in the story because it's not something you see a lot. So they're going to be people who are going to be doubting him and, you know, only comparing his skills to the one black surfer who did it 20 years ago. But like, I would totally watch that movie.
I've been pitching a version of that for a decade now.
Listen,
it's going to happen.
Oh, absolutely. It has to happen. I'm already excited about that idea. You know what I mean? But that's the thing, is that we have a myriad of ideas. And it's not us who needs the convincing. It's the people who have such a limitation around what Black life looks like. And I think that's what my film is kind of about, is a person who wants to tell a certain story. And, you know, the gatekeeper in my film, I don't see him as mustache twirly white dude. You know, he's not some evil guy. His intention, he thinks he's helping me by saying, listen, you want white people in it, you got to write white people in it. You know, right. Which I have been told that indirectly for years. Like, oh my God, we love this play. Do you have something else? Meaning, are there white people in the next play? Can it take place in the past? Can it be about war-torn Africa? Like, these are the messages that I've been getting over the years as a playwright. And so I'm just kind of sending up that the fact that the people with the most power tend to have the least amount of vision when it comes to our storytelling, you know? So yeah. I'm hoping that the 40-year-old version shakes that up too. It's like, there's going to be someone who maybe uses it as a comp now. Cause I remember when I was compiling my comps, getting my lookbook and my pitch deck together, there weren't many, and there weren't any with people who look like me, aside from Losing Ground by Kathleen Collins, like a film with, well, there wasn't any wide releases with Black woman artists at the center. You know, I know there's Watermelon Woman and Losing Ground, and She's Gotta Have It, but She's Gotta Have It was created by a man, and really the film is from a male point of view, right. But a female centric story that had a wide release with a Black woman artist at the center.
Right.
So maybe one day, you know, somebody's compiling. And also I feel like the messaging that I got was like, don't nobody want to hear no story about no artist. I kept hearing that. Like, that's not exciting enough. It's not thrilling enough. And yeah, so maybe one day it'll be a comp for somebody. They're like, you know, like 40-year-old version of an artist going through a journey, blah, blah, blah. I hope, you know.
It will. And I think I think it's just been gorgeous. One thing about the way the world moves now, and it living on the platform as opposed to like theaters and Gone, is seeing the manner in which it gets these waves of discovery and shared, and like it takes its time and continues to find its level. That's got to be gratifying.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, like, to be a part of filmmaking in this time, you know, when with everything that's going on, like, it does become an important hub or bastion of response to what's happening in our world. You know, like, I know that Two Distant Strangers is nominated for an Oscar, and it feels like I haven't seen it yet. Shout out to Jesse Williams. And I believe it's Trayvon Free is the filmmaker.
Yeah.
But it just, I don't know. It feels like that's how we have conversations now, is with content. It's like, we can send that to someone. There can be a conversation at a university or online about what we're experiencing, you know, and we can use that art to amplify the issues. I'm not, in my real life, I'm not the most articulate person. And when I say not articulate, I mean, like, I'm ruled by passion. So, like, you know, like I said, I'll be on Twitter talking about what's good or go off, sis. But if I have this thing, this content that says it maybe in a way that I might be limited in, then I feel like, you know, it's a multi-pronged attack around liberation of our people, you know, and let the artists come in too. You know, what is the Raoul Peck film? Destroy, Extinguish.
Why do I keep
spacing? We were just talking about it.
The extinguish all of the brutes. Exterminate all of the brutes. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's like, personally, it's not new information for me, mm-mm, but it's being presented in a way that his historical data is delivered in a way that's absolutely riveting and creative for those who maybe have a hard time articulating themselves about the history of colonialism in this world.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it's like, I think artists, like, we need to give artists their flowers and props in this battle, you know, for liberation and to push up against white supremacy and the institutions that have, like, silenced us and erased us for so long. Like, the art becomes the archive of our survival and, like, a blueprint. You know, someone like me, if I don't have art, I will be in the street. In fact, when I look at people who are considered, like, mentally deranged or whatever, they're expressing a part of themselves. Like, you know, maybe it's something that was suppressed or did not have the proper outlet. And I know for myself personally, if I don't have this outlet, I might be somewhere expressing myself in the same way too. So I wish people respected it as a healing agent, and a way to teach, a way to for people to affirm themselves. And, like, you know, I don't like anybody calling me a symbol, but I ain't gonna front. Like, when the poster was on 125th Street of a Black woman that's not a size 2, you know, who don't have no aquiline features, with a head wrap and big old door knockers on, I'm like, maybe somebody needs to see that. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's not to say, oh, let's just have all symbolism, but, like I said, multi-pronged attack,
yeah,
for our, you know, in terms of the fight for our liberation, and artists got something to say too.
Artists and activism have always gone hand in hand in working together. I mean, when I think about, mm-hmm, my father and his journey, you know, that's just what it was. It was the only way that he knew how to do it. The music, yeah, couldn't be independent from what was taking place in the world. And it was necessary, yeah, for those stories to mesh. What was it? What, you know, I know what it's like for me in the journey. And sometimes I have gone through areas of feeling like I'm an imposter syndrome because I come from such a big artist and a father who did so much. And especially as when you get to witness them as musicians and their work. And we share that similarity, mm-hmm, in being the children of musicians. What has that been like for you, working through your gift in that shadow?
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because I think while we share the experience of being the children of jazz musicians, I think what's different is, like, my father and even my mom as an artist were more unsung than your pops. I mean, your pops is like a shining star, you know what I mean? And my parents were shining in smaller ways, you know? So for me, if I'm being completely honest, there's sometimes been a lot of guilt because I, you know, someone said, like, my brother and I are like the miracles in our family because our parents didn't get to live out all of their artistic dreams, and we're still here with the ability to do so, you know. But I think sometimes especially when you grow up as a struggling artist or the child of struggling artists, you know, that can become a part of your identity. Mm. And it was for a very long time. And then one day I had to wake up and be like, wait a minute, you're in a house that Cookie and Lucius Lyon paid for, right? Because I used to write for Empire. And you're on this, you're in this space where your work, because it's on the Netflix platform, has a global audience. And there's just such a disparity between what my parents had to go through to remain artists and where I am. It's not to say I didn't have my struggles, but I have on some level surpassed them. I don't even like saying that shit, but I can say it when I know this is what my parents wanted for me. It's right. For me to, like, for them to run a certain part of the race and then pass that baton, for me to take it and to keep going in ways that they just aren't able to, because also they're just not here physically, you know. But I've felt a certain, sometimes I feel pride, you know, because sometimes I look in the mirror and I do see my father, I do see my mother. So it does feel like they are here. And then, like I said, sometimes I feel a little bit guilty because I'm not only no longer in that place of struggling, you know, like I'm doing okay for myself financially. I'm not. So I have to at some point let go of that identity, because right. It was so much a part of who I am, like struggling artist. I know what it's like to squat in the Lower East Side, you know, with my moms or my pops. You know, he had a talent. He was talented on the drums, but he also knew, like, when the light bill wasn't paid, he knew that there was another source in that damn street light outside. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
They were very creative in ways of survival. And so, yeah, it's always like me juggling two parts of my identity. It's like there's the pride, but then also just a little bit of guilt, because I know I'm going to have to leave that behind so that I can continue to do my work. I'm no longer that struggling artist. If I'm struggling, it might be some internal stuff. And, you know, that sometimes makes me feel a little away from them, which is why I think it's very easy for someone who, when you're the next generation of artists in your family and you're going further than them, I think it's easy for those artists to sabotage themselves because there's some internal guilt about surpassing their parents. But I'm definitely coming to terms with it, especially because I feel like the film is ours as a family. You know, there's a scene at the end when I finally come back to my mother's apartment and that's my brother and my father's jazz music is playing and that's my mother's artwork on the film. And so I feel like in that moment, it was my job to archive the family legacy in the film. That was my job. Was, yeah, I'm telling this movie, but also, like, now maybe more people can get excited about my father's jazz, and through the film, he's not as unsung.
I really appreciate everything you said about your parents, and they're in the nexus, just like, look at what we did. Look at what we did. I think it's so beautiful. I remember that you know, the way that scene played out and that moment with you and your brother, and it was just so, you felt like you were like you were in the room that you almost weren't supposed to be, because it was that real and that textural.
Yeah.
It's what a gift to them. The difference, I think, from my side was that I felt for a long time like I wasn't allowed to do anything. Like I felt very strange as I started to find my stride, and people would be like, well, why don't you do this? Aren't you Hugh Masekela's son? I went through a, you know, weird battles where when you said before, you know, offspring artists like engaging in self-sabotage, I was like, ow. Like, Rod, I'm right here. You don't have to say it to my face.
To Just trying to help, my friend. Just trying to help.
Because I did everything that I could in my power many times to try and literally sink my own ship just because of, there was some weird subliminal voice. It's like, you are not. Just stop. You know what's been done already with this name. Like, stop.
Right. Wow.
And my dad finally coming through. It was when my dad came to the X Games. He came to LA sometimes. Like, he called me. Like, when are those X Games taking place, man? I want to come and see that. I was like, what? He's like, no, I want to come and see that, man. Like, I want to come and see you do your thing. I said, you know, I just, no, I'm coming. So ESPN got him like a front row seat next to the vert ramp.
Wow.
And he never got up out of his chair. He was there for all of practice. And when it was over, you know, I'm commentating. They had a couple of shots of him. And there's my dad in the front row, like next to all the family. He's just like wide-eyed. And he came back to me and he was like, man, you know, it's like jazz what these guys do, man. He's like, I was watching them during practice, you know, and they're watching each other do the moves. And then the next guy drops in and you can see like they're picking up the rhythm and getting inspired to do some new shit. And they're grooving, man. They're jamming. Uh-huh. So he said, I can't believe you get to tell this to the world, man. You're lucky. Uh-huh. So proud of you. And I was like, oh. It was just such a simple thing, you know?
Yeah.
Because for years he was perplexed. Like, you know, he was kind of perplexed, like surfing. But then he really came to love and appreciate it. And I'd explain it to him musically. He's like, I get it, man. You're dancing on water. I get it.
Right. But beautiful.
I never thought he would.
Is that the name of the movie?
Yeah, that's the name. That's the name of the
movie. Is it really?
For sure. Yeah, I have it written down.
I love it.
Dancing on water all day. But yeah, it was really special. And then that just gave me allowance to do whatever I wanted to. It was actually more scary when I decided to make music and make my first Alakazam record. That's when I was like, he's going to be like, nah, motherfucker, you've gone too far. Which he was the complete opposite about. You know, he really embraced and made, when it was time, after I made the first record, he was like, it's beautiful, man. I forgot that you could sing like that. And he said, there's only one thing. I said, what? He said, don't make another one without me, man.
Oh.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
He said, yeah, man. Don't make another one without me. Call me next time. And sure enough, I called him. And he got on a plane from South Africa, came out here for 2 weeks. And, you know, we did a song together that ended up on the record. And, you know, that was the most beautiful thing we got to do. And then, he passed only 2 years later. So.
Wow. And y'all got that in. That's what a gift, you know.
It was wild.
And that must have been really cathartic for him. It's like finally getting to share that space with his son, you know, but on your terms, not like Hugh Masekela and his son. You know, it's like, this is your music, this is your expression, and he's coming along to like play, you know, have fun. So
it's crazy.
That's beautiful.
When we were done with it, and it was done. He called me like maybe 8 months later. He said, "Hey, I played that song for Sony, man. You know, I got a new record coming out, and they loved it." He goes, "I'm wondering, would you be okay if I put it out on my record first? Like, because I know you're not done with your album, but would it be cool?" I was like, "Bro," I was like, "Wait, you call?" He said, it's your shit, man. I came out to be on your shit. I can't just take it, man. Like, you know, it's your shit. And I never thought we would have a conversation at eye level like that.
Right.
About this thing.
Well, he's humbling himself to ask you.
Bugged.
How many times do people say, oh, and when are you doing your one man show? The father and son experience. How many times have people said that to you?
Me doing a one-man show?
Yeah.
People ask me all the time if I'm gonna if I would play him in something.
Because but playing him in something is one thing, but yeah. Like portraying him in a say like a live performance piece or some mixed media piece where you are embodying him and then coming back to you.
Nobody's ever said that one. And
because right I
when,
see it.
When you said that, I just saw it when you said it. I was like, oh, wait.
Because the reason I say it is because.
You just gave me chills, Radha.
Well, one thing is like, I'm telling you, like, I always felt like I was my mother's baby, you know? And she passed on first, and that was very devastating to me. And then my father passed on after her. But I was, even in the wake of his passing, which was, he passed in 2018.
Mine too.
When?
January 28th.
Okay. October 28th, 2018. And maybe they're jamming.
I was just saying. I was just thinking the exact same thing.
They out there jamming. And fighting over that check, you know, and when that money come in, you know how it is with musicians. Like, now wait a minute, man. Now I done bought in the bass player and the xylophone player, you know. But no, the point I'm making is that I'm seeing more and more of my father in my face now, for better or for worse. But watching you just now, like in our Zoom, like take him on and then go back to Salima and then take him on again, like your whole face change. And I think it could be something really interesting, you know, and maybe cathartic for you. And then you guys will get to do that song again in front of a live audience or something, whatever. You know, I just be thinking.
No, you things. Just, we're going to have to offline this one. I'm not kidding. I mean, literally, you're the only person that I could do something like that with, honestly. You're the only person that knows the space and that I would even feel safe having that discussion with, because as foreign as it is, and I probably would be like, no, you started talking about it and I saw it and I was like, shit, she got me to see it.
I mean, who else though? But who else? And I'm saying, because otherwise you have to wait, unless you're going to finance, write, direct, and produce the movie version and then play Embody Your Dad. Mm. You know, like, one thing I can't wait to do is like get back to theater. You know, like I really am missing that experience, and not just as a performer or a producer or a creative, but being in the audience when somebody is like going through the motions on stage, and whether it's like projections or the soundscape and this performer or these performers, you know what I mean? And I feel like, you know, yeah, you could do the film version of it, but you could, who else would him embody him in a theater piece? No. And who knows him better than you? Mm-mm. You know what I mean? Like, instead of seeing a fictionalized version where it's you playing your dad and they hire some actor to play you, it's like, shit, you do both. Fuck it. Like,
Miss Blank.
I'm just throwing it out there.
No, you done land. You threw it and it hit me. You threw it. I just threw it out there and hit you upside the head with it.
You did his mouth and everything, and you know, because look, it would be that, or they'd hire some actor.
Oh yeah,
you know, probably some British dude to play your dad, or to play you in the movie. You know, and he'd have to come to you, and he's like, "Yeah, so which part of Essay is your father from?" Like,
wait, why did you
I want to get it right. I want to get the dialect right. You know, like, and your dad, well, he stand like this. Whereas now you have autonomy and you have control, you know?
Why did you just do Daniel Kaluuya like that?
No, but let me tell you something. You know why I'm working on my accent? Because I'm determined, man. Like, I'm determined to, like, play a British person in a film one day.
You got it really good, though. I'm listening determined. To you.
I've been working on it. You know what I mean? Bruv. I've been working on it because I'm going to play someone British, and I want to, and what, bruv? And who's going to say something about it? Nobody. I'm going to do it. Watch. So I'll be, look, you do your play, right? And then I come out and I could be the British promoter, and I'll be like,
yes.
Listen, Hugh, listen, they all love you. They love you. But like, this is all you're going to get tonight on this gig, man. I'm sorry. I don't know what to say. I'm just bullshitting. I'm just playing around. Not really, but that's something we enjoy. That's something me and Joy will tell you about later.
Okay. To be continued.
Because we're all conspiring to work together. And I'm always nervous about working with friends. You know, like, I wouldn't say it took a lot for Lena to convince me to say yes to her producing my movie, but I'm always nervous about it. And Joy is actually one of my closest friends. So I'm nervous, but like, yo, come on. She's gold. And when I'm with her, it's like, somebody needs to be recording this conversation, because there's always like a million sitcoms and shows and
so many,
you know, so I can only imagine what you guys are cooking up. But
that's why I literally just showed up one day with the mic at her house. I was like, let's smoke something and sit.
Listen, is it OK? Well, now we got, that's what you got to put in the credits.
Yes.
You got to give the weed the credit, because that's what happened with us too. Like, we were sitting around bullshitting, and then I don't know if it was like it's we started to sober up, and then we looked at each other like, no, really, this could be something. But it usually started with that bubble pipe. Oh shit, am I saying too much information?
Like, we live in California. It's good.
Talk about this when you guys were together about her bubble pipe.
Yes.
Right. So that bubble pipe. Right. This was when Bubba, God rest the dead.
Yes.
Her dog was still alive. He was such a piece of gold. I loved him. But like, we come together, we smoke that bubble pipe. And then like, just the inspiration, the ideas would just come falling out. And
we whittled down the episode that we did, which was still 90 minutes with my half hour intro, was actually 3-hour and 15-minute conversation on her couch. I thought it was an hour.
Yeah, see, that's like good shit. You know what I mean? You done transported in time. Now you're 4 days later. You're like, it was just 30 minutes, but that was at her house.
Yeah, it was
her house has that effect.
It sucks you in
every time I'm there. It's like a mini Shangri-La.
It seems like a nice segue to that's just all time, by the way, where we just the foolishness that just went down is all time. Thank you.
Oh my god,
if the show wasn't yeah, that's all time. It has been so sweet.
It was a great conversation, and like, you know, this is me kind of like ending my talking, you know what I mean, in the world, because I just want to kind of disappear and just be an artist again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I have maybe one more conversation with another person who's like one of my closest friends. And so like, this is perfect. Like, it feels like home. So thank you for carving out space and like having a real conversation with me, you know, because I am a person, not a product.
No.
So
I only know you as a person and
right. Exactly. That's why this is perfect.
I got to you making like a dope ass product on the back end and being like, no, but you don't understand. Like, I know her. I've worked with her. She's directed me. We wrote something.
We've been on Funny or Die.
Yes.
It's
in your bio, by the way, on Wikipedia.
Listen.
And I was like, yes.
I don't know who does that. I don't know who did that. But
I know.
I'm glad it's on there. I'm very proud of that shit. Because like I remember when we like made it on the front page, I was like, oh, and you know what's funny? I got to just say this. It's like, at some point I was like, they're going to call us. They're going to call us to do a Sambo series.
Right? You are not alone. I told my friends, like, it's about to be on. We're the first. We are the first ones. We were the first people, really. People hadn't done the Trump parodies yet. And I was like, oh, we're first. No. Like, it's rap. Like, we're about to go big. Yeah. Like, you know, Will Ferrell is going to call and be like, hey, we're calling you up to the big leagues.
Right.
You know, he's the like,
and if you need a couple of cutaways of a Trump, I'll play Trump for you.
Yeah. The Sambo series. Like, it's on. But they missed.
Hey, they listen. They're lost. They're lost. No, this has been awesome. I'm so very not to sound like I'm your mother or anything, but very proud of you. Like the moves that you've made in the, you know, since we met a few years ago, like you really are like, you know, opening up your storytelling voice as an actor, as a performer, and still like, you know, dedicated and committed to this surf life. Cause I follow you on Instagram. Even when you do your exercises, I do them with you in my mind. I'm like, oh yeah. And 1, 2, 3, whew, breathe. Right. And then left and right. You know, I don't actually get up from laying down.
Your comments are some of my favorites.
But the spirit, I'm like, you know, if I was a personal exercise, this is how I'd be doing. Thank you. Thank you, friend, for doing it for me.
I was a late bloomer, you know. That was never my thing. It was really? Only in the last like maybe 7 years that I showed up really, really late to it. And it shocked me because I never thought I'd become. But now I am a literal addict. I'm that person.
Oh, listen.
I'm on some Black LaLanne.
I can smell your sweat through your coat. So I know you're real. I'm like, ooh, that's a sweat. Well, you keep on doing it and maybe I'll bloom 7 years behind and I'll, you know, be lifting up cars and shit. I don't know. You be doing some all kinds of like.
If you're ever in a bind and you need some shit moved or picked up, you know, just know that like.
I know who to call.
I got you.
I know who to trust with my two ton car.
And you actually, I mean, you do have my wheels turning, so.
Let them turn, bruh. Let them turn. That's what they're there for.
And now I'm going to stay. Well, I'm going to stay on you on your fictional band book.
Listen.
I'm going to be like, yo, where is it? You know, Penguin called and they need the book.
Listen. This was amazing.
Thank you, Radha.
Thank you very much.
I literally like, I love you. You are a sister to me.
I love you too, bro.
And always I'm here.
Same here. See you in the real world soon.
Yeah, in the room where it's happening. To be continued.
Much love.
Be well.
Yes.
All right.
You too. Take care.
It takes a village to bring you the What Shapes Us podcast. Our incredible graphic design team at Parsons Branding. Music by the one and only Hugh Masekela. And my band, Alakazam. It is edited by Ernesto Hurtado and Will Broughton. Produced by yours truly, Salema Mabena Masekela. And directed by Ernesto Hurtado, a.k.a. Machete, and myself, Salema Masekela. The What Shapes Us podcast is a Rebel Talk Network production. Stick to the pace, you're a rat in the race. That's all you can give, but ain't all that it takes. Put your money on the wall, but it won't buy taste. Surprised to catch shine when you stop to embrace. Breathe, don't wanna watch you go under. Fly, don't wanna see you burn. Please, they're gonna take your thunder. Why you wanna miss your turn? Easy, don't paint by numbers. Fortune only favors the bold. Sweat, no money, no motion. Plant these trees of coffee and gold.